Hello, and welcome to Further Research Needed, the only research institute studying the long-term stability of geniuses under ambient conditions. My name is Christopher Wood, and as usual, I'm joined by my co-hosts,
Jan-Philipp Reising
and Hannes Weyrer.
And today, in a slight change, I'm stoked to announce we have a special guest, Dr. Derek Roberts, all the way from Sydney, Australia. Derek, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So Derek and I used to work together over two institutions and have been talking about science over coffee breaks and beers for ages. So it's really great to have you on today. Do you mind telling us a bit about what you're currently up to?
Sure. So I'm an early career researcher at the University of Sydney, and the main thrust of my research focuses on studying how we can get self-assembled polymer structures that adopt certain nanostructural morphologies, so certain very tiny, tiny shapes, how we can get those to transform into different types of shapes in response to stimuli such as, you know, heat, ideally enzymes, changes in pH. So the key idea there is if you can change the nanoscale morphology of any material, you can change its salient properties. And being able to do that in a controllable way, I think, will give rise to new generations of very interesting soft materials. So that's the main focus of my research.
Derek, it's really exciting to have you on the show. Today, I want to ask the question, is science teaching fit for purpose? This has come from a lot of discussions we've been having about our teaching styles. I know, Derek, you do a lot of teaching currently. Mm-hmm. Mainly university teaching, but this question goes across all eras of education. So teaching in high school, teaching in undergrad, teaching in for PhD. And something that we've questioned quite a lot is, why are we teaching people science? Do we want people to, is it necessary for the whole world to memorize the periodic table, know all of the different laws by different physicists, and so on and so forth? Or are we teaching people to question and to apply the scientific method? And I think this is a very salient point currently, as people, certainly the public, is engaging with scientific research, sometimes for the first time, but certainly in a much stronger way than they have previously because of the current crisis. So I wonder if Derek, you could talk about, first of all, some of the teaching you've done, but also getting into the question of what you think science teaching is for, let's say, starting with undergrad.
Absolutely. So much like I think everyone involved in this podcast, I feel very, very strongly about teaching. I think it's the one key deliverable that anyone working at a university can have beyond their research. There's no guarantee that a research idea is going to work out, generate technology. It's speculative by its very nature. But the one commodity that I think we can all guarantee is teaching new generations of scientists, mentoring students well, because that's really just a function of effort, in my opinion. You can have a good output in terms of making sure students understand topics, think scientifically, are able to deconstruct complex information and get to the crux of what that information tells you. That really, I think, is the main commodity that universities and anyone in our sort of role as sort of like, you know, scientists and teachers can deliver. And sometimes I think that's forgotten by the general public. And I think and this is an entirely other topic, but the increasing corporatization of universities, I think, is maybe distracting away from the role that we have as teachers. But that may be a topic for another podcast. So my experience in teaching really centers around university lecturing, mentoring students in my research lab. So that's where we have, I guess we provide a context in the laboratory for what the students are learning in their lectures and how they can apply it to real research problems. So that's where the bulk of my teaching comes from at the moment. But I've also taught with high schools and particularly with Chris, I've done some science outreach. And there's a really interesting, I guess, split between how students at universities engage with quite complex research topics and how the general public does. And I think there's a lot of misinformation. The sources where people in the general public get their ideas about science aren't necessarily what they learned at high school. And I think what I hear a lot when I do science outreach, the number of people that's come up to me and say, I don't know what chemistry is useful for. I didn't like it at school. I didn't have a very good teacher. So I think a lot of the problems that we have in how the general public engages with science comes back down to how it's taught at high school. And if we think that there are problems with how the public engages with science, it probably starts there. So, Chris, this is a really excellent question you've come up with. Is science education fit for purpose? I guess we have to think about what the purposes are. So you have some thoughts about the purposes across, I guess, a range of different age groups, right?
I mean, you just made the connection, Derek, of where you drew two different pictures here. One of undergrad, what Chris asked, and then you spoke about the high school education and how it relates to, what would you say, the non-scientific public, to people who don't have formal scientific education, but still, of course, have to engage with it because we live in a, because the main feature or the defining feature of our society is science and technology, while it was maybe Christianity in the medieval ages. So that's why everyone will inevitably get in contact with science, right? Then I guess what we're asking is, since high school is the last time they get formal science education, what's the purpose of this education? And I'm not entirely sure myself. I have some opinions, but maybe you want to shoot first.
Me?
I don't know. Did I take this away from you, Chris? Now, did I jump ahead?
No, it's good. It's good. I think I completely agree. I think the point you brought up, Derek, where people's engagement with science is through their science, their early introduction to science from their science teachers. And often people are put off at that early stage from continuing to study science. A lot of it, anecdotally from my experience of being taught science, a lot of the early stages are by rote learning of laws or facts or classifications of objects, which is somewhat dry and is somewhat off-putting to a lot of people, I think, because there's no mental flexibility in there's no engaging with topics. And I think this is kind of why I picked this question, because now, given the internet, given the access to huge databases of facts and figures, the use of the human brain to just absorb information, that's such a waste of a complex processing power of the brain, that I think we need to think about a new form of teaching, starting from the ground up, starting from high school and then moving through to university education, because there's no, it's putting too many people off, and also it's reducing our ability to understand what the scientific method does for people or does for society and for helping people engage with science later on in their lives.
I think you're
right.
So
what do we want from high school? Sorry, Philip, go on.
I think you're right, but I sort of agree and disagree. So there's this really long argument that's been going on for ages is, does it make sense to learn certain things by heart, right? Does it make sense to like learn how to multiply big numbers in your head because you're going to have a calculator at any time? Does it really make sense? And I think it's not a super easy question to answer, because in some areas, you're going to be way faster if you have the knowledge. You're not always going to be able to access those stores of information you were talking about. And sometimes you will, but sometimes you won't. So I think that's a difficult question. But maybe to anchor the discussion a bit more, to get back to this goal, I think we need to split high school and then university education and say the goal of high school education would maybe be to give everyone in society a broad understanding of science so they can interact with the science that they come across. And then university would maybe be preparing you for a more or less specific job or job field.
So I have a question here.
Okay.
When you say, or do you mean that the high school students learn what the world looks like according to science, or how science came to the conclusion about the world right now? Because from what I see is that we are taught facts about how the world is.
And I think that's very valid, right? But I think our criticism from what I'm hearing right now is sort of that we're doing maybe a better job at the explaining what we think the world is like right now versus teaching them how science works and how we came to those conclusions, right?
Right. And which one would you prefer? Which one do we want? Do we as a society want? And individuals, maybe.
I think both are necessary. But I think we're failing in the how do we get to this conclusion and the like teaching the scientific method and not just like similar to what Chris said, instead of giving the facts, including more into the process, why do we have these facts? How did somebody actually get to this point, right?
Right. Now, if we're being super pragmatic, one would say that there's only so much time in education and we would have to cut out some facts in order to teach the way of thinking. Assuming we don't want to cut out on other non-scientific subjects, and I don't want to go this far, but just in the hours spent on science education, what do we feel comfortable not teaching in terms of facts? And instead we teach, let's say, science philosophy, scientific thinking, problem solving according to the scientific method and these things.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with the premise that we have to cut things out. So Chris's point about rote learning being off-putting, I think, is universal. Like, I hated history. I hated studying history at high school. And that's because it was taught to us in a series of facts. And I didn't understand why these were important. Why was I learning about these isolated little bits of history in a piecemeal way? But now, as an adult, I'm interested in, how did, fascism arise in some countries, or communism, or other kinds of political ideologies? And it's because the facts that I was learning weren't linked to a context. So the key point I want to make there is that I think learning anything has a rote component to it. But if there's context to, I understand why I'm learning this, then the facts kind of fall in place. They just become the vocabulary so that you can speak the language, whether that is the language of history or an actual literal language or the language of science. And university, I think that's relatively easy to solve. So students are already there because they want to study science at a higher level. So you've already got them interested. They already care, and so you can abuse that a little bit. It's like, when some teachers, if you've got a really smart student, you often don't have to try as hard with them. I would never say I'd personally do this, but I've seen this happen before, because you're going to retain their interest anyway. They're going to go do their own thing. They're going to find things out. And I think what education should aim for is to raise the average standard of how people engage with the topic, try and capture and not lose the people at the bottom end, and provide an opportunity for mastery at the top end. But the focus really should be, and does tend to be, I think, right in the middle. So like I was saying, at university, the easy context building is to give students research experience. Because then that allows them to really build intuition about what they're learning, the facts in the lectures, and put it into a real world, in inverted commas, context that they understand why it's important. Like, I understand why I'm learning kinetics, because I want to solve this problem that involves needing to measure different rates and compare them. The thing that I'm most concerned about is, how do we provide this context at high school? Because as Chris, Jan Philip, Hannes, you've all mentioned, increasingly the world is so dependent on technology that's complicated and can be pernicious and can be manipulated and is manipulated politically. So what I think scientific critical thinking, I think, really captures is how to look at complex information and to, I guess, look at it critically in a way that I don't believe this and I want to run some kind of experiment, whether that's a physical or thought experiment, to disprove what's being told to me. And I think that's very different to the kind of thinking or critical thinking that arises in, say, English literature or any sort of more humanities or social sciences based focus. Maybe not so much the social sciences, but humanities, where you want to prove a point. Science doesn't try to prove points, or when done correctly, shouldn't prove points. And this comes back to Jan Philip's idea about what's the scientific method.
Yeah, so I completely agree with Derek's point there, that critical thinking is something that is key to everyone and should be taught better in science, because I think the scientific method gives you that ability to either do a thought experiment or a real experiment to see if something is true or not. And I think it's a question that none of us can really answer, because we've not tried to teach in a classroom setting at school to those sorts of ages. But I wonder if we had a teacher from high school, whether they would agree that at that stage of development, kids are able to engage with the uncertainty around, say, the necessary uncertainty around critical thinking. I tend to think you can give kids a lot of difficult topics and see how they engage with it, but I wonder in terms of course structure and engagement by all members of the classroom rather than just the top end of the class, whether that would be feasible or not. I don't know. Has anyone done any outreach to this sort of age, school age of kids?
Yeah, no, I've done quite a bit of high school outreach in Australia in particular. And I think you're right that maybe a high school teacher might have the attitude, whether justified or not, that if we... you mentioned the word uncertainty, and I think if my understanding of what you mean by that is that nothing, like the facts in science aren't really facts. Like the key tenet of any scientific idea is that it's disprovable. And so when we, you know, say the theory of gravity, and the way we use the word theory, I think, is an important point as well, that I don't want to go off into a tangent too much, but like, you know, the rigid definition of a theory versus when someone says, oh, it's a wild-eyed random idea, and how it's usually used in not common parlance. When we say like a model of how we understand something to work, so say the theory of gravity that I mentioned just a second ago, there's an equation that describes how that works for most sort of purposes, you know, planets being interacting with each other over relatively short timescales, for relatively predictable things. But it's not really a fact. It's a mathematical equation that more or less describes very well how two things are attracted to each other. Newton's laws are similar as well. You know, there's a common analogy that I make that, you know, there's Newton's laws and Einstein's laws, and both tell you a certain level of answer. I think we'll probably talk about this in a second. But they give you answers to different levels of granularity. So I think what you mean by uncertainty is that can students handle the idea that our understanding of how things works, how things work, are, I guess, attenuated or matched to the quality of the answer that we want. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, I think so. It's whether they can handle that at that age.
I think this touches upon something slightly different, which is very important still. What you just said, Derek, kind of, or to put it this way, I think in order to ask a good question or critically assess anything that is told, you have to understand quite a lot about it already. And I think that's difficult, especially in high school education, because people usually start off with no knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's why we have the education, right? So if you want to talk about something like two different models that explain gravity, we have to have an intuition of how gravity works. And for children, usually that's just down, right? There's no attraction between masses. We just know things fall to the ground. That's all we know. Mm. And I think that makes it difficult to critically assess that. Like if you were, of course, it would be far outside of high school, but if you were to ask a high school student, it's like, how does light interact with gravity or something like that? They would just look at you, I think, because the concepts are not there to process that, to critically assess that.
But I think there's also a bias, right? So all the high school outreach that we might have done, or the way we think about high school students, is sort of tinted by the fact that we have the sort of education that we have, right? So if you would try to change the way how we educate people, or especially students at that age, their answers and the way they, the answers they're looking for, the kinds of questions they're asking might be quite different if you're not in such a vocabulary-based, quote-unquote, system.
Right. What are you thinking of? Can you elaborate?
So what I'm thinking is, like, all of what you said sort of points me into the direction of, yes, yeah, scientific method, but also trying to figure out stuff on your own instead of just giving the answer, right? Derek, like you were saying, oh, in history, it's just like, oh, 1987, this is what happened. But then, like, how do we know that and all of that kind of stuff? So even in high school, I think it's pretty bad, but in university, it doesn't really get better. It's like usually the sense that there's one answer and you know where that answer is. It's like either in that textbook or it's in the lecture or it's somewhere else. But in reality, when, like, during my PhD, I know there is an answer, but I have to figure out how to do that. And that's really bad. So my teachers used to say, oh, Wikipedia is not a good source. But nowadays, I always use Wikipedia as my first go-to point, and then I have a process of how to get there. But I never got that education of how to actually get the answer that I need, right?
I think there's a really great point there as well. Just let me give me a second to gather some thoughts on that. Hang on. So I just need, because I was going to write down a point that you raised from there. Sorry, can you just run through again what you, yeah, you know, can you just run through again the key points of what you just said there? Because I had something, I just lost it for a second.
So my idea would be, so we get taught the vocabulary or the facts, and usually there's one source where that fact comes from.
I remember,
right?
Yeah,
that's
so
supposed to be correct.
I remember the point that I was going to make there. So like in what you just said, I think there was a really key point and something that I've observed with a lot of my students, and it's the idea of like, where do these facts come from? So you've mentioned the scientific method a few times, and it's about a process rather than a set of facts. So a common occurrence when students first join my group to start working on research is that I ask them to do some kind of experiment that, like, you know, mixing two chemicals together and figuring out what the outcome is going to be before they do it, and then trying to sort of like, you know, rationalize what the outcome was. And I've had a few students say to me before, this shouldn't work. You know, this experiment shouldn't work for whatever reason, because the theory that I learned told me that, you know, this shouldn't happen. And we do the experiment and it happens. And then they go, no, but the theory's right and the experiment's wrong. And I think this is a distortion. This really, I think, comes down to the danger of teaching students facts, is that the facts are almost always incomplete. One that's in chemistry, and I don't want to go too far into chemistry because I know we're not talking to just chemists, but the idea of a nucleophile, so, you know, something with electrons that can, you know, do a chemical reaction. And there are tables of, you know, whether a nucleophile is strong or weak and whether it does a reaction quickly or slowly. The problem is that that theory are just a bunch of rules of thumb. No one really understands where they come from. There are different measures of that. And if you rely on the theory and don't think about the context, like a big context in chemistry is solvent. You know, these tables are defined for a particular solvent. Then you try and port that same knowledge to a different solvent. It doesn't work anymore. And so what I want to try and encourage my students at least to do is to run the experiment and try and get an understanding using the tools that they have of, like, you know, if you're not sure whether what the mechanism is, do an experiment to verify the mechanism. People in the 1800s, 1900s, you know, the ideas of physical chemistry or physics or physical biology were about using measurements and experiments to develop the model and to validate models. But nowadays, it seems like, and maybe, you know, this is a very dangerous, like, you know, back in my day kind of argument, but it seems like, or maybe it's been a problem since time immemorial, but it seems like students really want to focus on, no, I learned this fact and therefore it's true, without understanding how that fact came about through understanding mechanism in physics and all physical chemistry, physical biology, etc., how we've put numbers on experimental observations. And that's where I think it really has to start with. Like, if you're going to teach about gravitation, you know, just the famous, was it Archimedes, dropping the balls from, or was it Galileo? No, it was the Galileo sort of ball drop experiment, you know, where you go to the top of the Tower of Pisa and drop a heavy bowling ball and a light bowling ball, and you ask which one's going to hit the ground first, right? You know, any one of the, or an inclined plane experiment, or an inverse square law experiment. You could tell the student, here's the law, and this is how it works. Or you could start with a lab class and have them plot observations and have them say, you know, okay, well, what did the data look like? And from there, you can start to build up the theory. And then at the end of the lesson, you go, great, what you've just done is what Isaac Newton did back in 1700 something, or what Galileo did in whenever. And you make them the scientist. And I think that provides the context. Start with the observation so they understand where the law came from. That's kind of how I'd like to change how high school's taught.
I think that that's a really great example there, because that thought experiment or experiment that you do in high school, the bowling ball and the feather, is one of the most irritating experiments to be taught as a kid, because you can physically drop a bowling ball and a feather, and when you see with your own eyes, the bowling ball drops first and the feather stays floating for a while before it hits the ground. And then you're taught the law that says that shouldn't happen. And you're sitting there kind of confused, and you're like, okay, well, that's fine. And then the teacher usually just fluffs over the end bit and be like, oh yeah, but that's because of air resistance and blah, 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 and it moves on. And you're like,
Do the experiment in vacuum then, as was it Neil Armstrong on the moon who dropped the hammer and the feather and they dropped it at the same time?
Yeah.
Or they've done it.
I think they evacuated a huge cylinder.
They did this at my university every year. They have two evacuated cylinders and boop,
No, there was. I think what Chris is mentioning is that there's some room for testing space equipment that I think is maybe the Kennedy Space Center, or I'm not sure where it is, but it's a room where you can generate a huge vacuum. And they did this exact experiment with the bowling ball and the feather, like on a big scale. And I think this also comes to a good point. There is the bowling ball and the feather. You notice how I said heavy bowling ball and light bowling ball, because this is also a key idea about how do you design experiments. And this is something that's even missing at university, is how do you design an experiment that has an outcome that's not already influenced by how you set up the experiment? So if you dropped a feather and a bowling ball and you just go, oh, they dropped at different rates, then you would, the conclusion you draw is you disprove gravity. And that's probably a very pernicious conclusion to draw, right? And you can show it to someone. If I was talking to someone, this is what sophistry is, right? Is I wanted to say to someone, gravity doesn't exist. And they go, well, no, I know gravity does exist. And I was like, ah, watch this. Bowling ball and a feather. Gravity says they should fall at the same rate. And I drop them and they drop at different rates. The person might be flabbergasted. They'd be like, oh my God, gravity doesn't exist. And we'll start trying to jump to the moon and things like that. And it's because we've biased the experiment. It's very easy. And this is something that I notice all the time with the research students I have. And maybe this is about the fit for purpose at university, maybe at an undergrad. And I don't want to jump around too much, but I think this is an important point, is how do you arrive at, or how do you design an experiment to most elegantly disprove the idea that you want, that you're trying to, I guess, illustrate. So if you pick the bowling ball and a feather, the variable there, as Chris pointed out, was wind resistance. And so you've already influenced the experiment. So if I wanted to, say, disprove gravity, well, I've designed an experiment that's going to just do it anyway, but I haven't questioned what the variables are or the assumptions that I'm making in order to most honestly try and, say, disprove my idea of trying to disprove gravity. So if I really want to be honest about trying to disprove gravity, I get two balls with the same size and different masses, and I drop them and they'd fall and hit the ground at the same time. And therefore, if my hypothesis was gravity doesn't exist, I would have disproved it. And the experiment I designed was honestly trying to disprove it. And that's another point that I think really is important, is how scientific critical thinking differs from other forms of critical thinking. I think that idea of disproof is something that I think is important to build in, that really isn't touched on at all at high school. And Jan, Philip, you mentioned the scientific method over and over again. I think that's the core, like the central principle of the scientific method is disprovability.
So I think this is kind of a good good time to move towards the undergrad teaching of science now. So it's in our hypothetical world, say that we're managing to teach kids their critical thinking, the scientific method, and an ability to sort of semi-run thought experiments and experiments in their minds. They've now come from high school. They've obviously chosen the science, so we're self-selecting now somewhat. What is the purpose, and is science teaching fit for purpose at undergrad?
So in a way, you could argue that the university as an academic institution should train its students to become academics, to become scientific researchers, and should educate them for work in research. And this was probably true 50, 80 years ago, when most university graduates could become academic researchers or even professors. Most of them could. Today, I think we have positions for 10% of them in academia, which inevitably means
it's even less.
Yeah, exactly. Which means inevitably we cannot employ all of them as researchers. So this point of, or so the implicit point that in academia or at university, we train academic researchers doesn't hold anymore. So what do we train them for?
Well, you're speaking about researchers in the academy, but I mean, there's research in the private sector. There's research in commerce.
Absolutely.
You know, having a scientific skill set and the ability to solve complex problems, I think, pays dividends anywhere. I firmly believe that pretty much everyone can benefit from a science degree. And indeed, I think the more common trope is that everyone benefits from doing an engineering degree, because most engineers don't work as engineers. They work in the finance sector, or they work in abroad, you know, in the computer science sector. So arguably an engineering degree is even more broadly useful to society than a science degree, because you can do everything a commerce graduate would do, or, you know, someone who does humanities, maybe except for writing well, which is something I've noticed to any engineers sort of listening.
So. I agree with a certain caveat, and it's something basically coming back to, yeah, if you only learn the facts in your science education, then you're not going to be able to do any other kind of job, right? If you're so deep into your niche, then you have to do that job. But I think the value I and probably most of you see in science is exactly that method and the process and a couple of other skills, like having a very high tolerance for failure, that kind of give you an edge in other fields or make you useful for other fields as well. But coming back to Hannes' question is, like, what is then the goal of higher education, right? If it's not academia anymore, getting us into this small niche, do we have to change how bachelor's, master's, PhDs are structured?
Well, one little thing I want to mention there is it's a very good question, Jan Philip, but I think it's a very dangerous question, because I think, at least in my country, the common response to that would be, oh, well, we need to prepare the students for the job market. And so a science degree becomes vocational training. We decide, oh, well, they might need to know how to use an HPLC, or they might need to know how to use an NMR, and they become technicians. And I think that isn't, for me at least, the key of why you do an undergraduate degree in science. You think you want to develop these problem-solving skills. You want to be able to think about the world, see if you're a chemist in molecular terms, and how, you know, these come together in the interaction of matter with itself. In physics, the interaction with matter and light, or light with itself or others, just broadly speaking, or biology, the processes under which underpin how, you know, all of life works. I think there are deeper questions that I think there's no danger in having people become better at thinking about problems. I think there's danger in saying people who go to undergraduate need to leave with skills that are exactly aligned with the job market, because I think that just stifles the ability of the commercial sector to be able to create new technologies and solve problems that they didn't realize they had.
I think the argument I was trying to make was the exact opposite.
Oh, no, I'm sure that, yeah.
If you have a very broad education in science, the reasoning, to use your words, is going to give you an edge in most jobs that you can do. But I agree that there's a tendency to kind of, yeah, make science into more of a technical job.
My apologies. I just want to say my apologies. I didn't mean to, like, say, I'm sure you were agreeing with me. I sort of strung up another straw man. I'm imagining, like, a local member of Parliament in Australia who goes, oh, it needs to be vocational training. I'm absolutely sure all four of us agree on this point.
Yeah, I think most people would agree with you, but now my question is, honestly, the three of you, do you think you received, or that in your undergrad education you received the thinking tools for thinking scientifically? Because I think I didn't.
I think I agree with you. I think, to be honest, one of the biggest, the tool that I learned, the most useful tool and the most sort of critical thinking areas that I learned or gained from my science education happened as I moved into PhD, where I started engaging with how science is done, so how the literature is curated, and then actually directly using the literature to try and cause some effect in the lab, and finding out that most literature is 80%. Correct, but there is failures at every level, and that science isn't this production of facts and truths instantly. It's a cyclical process that over time builds up a general body of knowledge that is, broadly speaking, accurate. And that learning that was a major point in my scientific career. And I think I would like undergrads to start learning that, because I think taking that knowledge earlier on would give you a lot more skills, even outside of science, outside of the laboratory, because then you begin to look at news media and information that you're given in a different light. You want multiple sources. You know, you start off at Wikipedia, but you also branch out from there and see what other corroborating evidence is around. And I think that skill is very broadly applicable, especially to other industries and that sort of thing. That's one of the most valuable skills that science graduates take following on, but it came almost too late in my education. It came when I was already down the academic path and I was going to become a professor eventually down that line. But yeah.
Now, this might be a bit of an unpopular opinion, but I think the way to that can go through scientific education, but I think the way can also go through, or complementary to that, we can get there by learning about formal science philosophy and the history of science, specifically of our specific field. In the field of chemistry, this would be the periodic table, which we take for granted had such a long and convoluted history. Learning about the history of, in this case, maybe chemistry, would teach us about all the wrong assumptions. One of the things that Derek mentioned earlier was the theories and models, or theories in the very scientific sense. And one of the famous ones that we learned about is the structure of the atom, where we, in high school, at least I learned that the electrons orbit the nucleus on like on these planes. And then later on you learn, oh, that's actually not true. So you they're in these electron clouds, in these orbitals around the nucleus and so on. And what I thought then would happen within me was, oh, well, this model of these electrons on their orbits, that's just wrong and dumb, and it's bad science. And only much, much later, I learned to appreciate that as the ingenious idea of this was, of the model that Niels Bohr proposed, that could very accurately explain a lot, but just not everything. So I looked down on older, at this point, outdated scientific ideas and couldn't appreciate them at all for what they were. And I think with some education in philosophy and history of science, we could counteract that and make people appreciate incomplete models, or models and their limitations.
I really, really, really like your point. And it feeds back into something Derek said regarding internships and doing practical work in the lab. I think one of the biggest things for me during my PhD was having failure and how to deal with failure, and kind of coming to terms with failure being a very regular, completely acceptable part of doing science. And I think that's also what you're saying, Hannes, right? That philosophy of science is one of the little, or like small, areas where you actually can come into contact with failure and science and have it in a way presented that you understand that it's not a failure. Like in high school, oh, you get like a 6- and you just failed your class. But it's like all of this, like standing on the shoulders of giants is like the one of the central things. And you know that sentence, but you don't really know what it means in reality, standing in the lab, banging your head against the wall for 6 months and nothing works.
If I can add one more thing to that, is that especially with the philosophical education, what happened earlier is that Derek spoke about falsification of our models. And this is, I'm not sure if you're aware of that, because we lack this philosophical education in our science degrees, but this is exactly the main point of Karl Popper, who proposed that in the 1930s, I think. Like one of the foundations of science philosophy today. But we're not taught that in a formal way. We're not, at least I was never taught about falsification, verification, and all these things.
Could you give us a brief overview of that point, the falsification methodology?
Yeah, so Popper's point was that that good science falsifies its own models, and it builds models that can be falsified. And the scientist then goes out and tries to disprove the model. This would, for example, work in the way that you construct a model that, let's say, through mathematical equations, tells you how a specific aspect of the world works. In Einstein's case, this was the theory of relativity that explained how space and time interact with matter. And it was supposed to solve certain issues that people had, because at the time people still believed in the ether as being the medium that transports light and so on. And this model made certain predictions. Means if we go out and observe certain events, something would happen that wouldn't happen in a different event. And this model was prepared for the case that the event would not take place, and this would disprove the model. Maybe not altogether, but would call for the necessity of changes to the model, which would lead to new predictions, which could again be falsified. And if the experiment does not falsify the hypothesis, this doesn't mean the model is true, just that it didn't fail at this instance, so we have further reason to keep using it. And what Karl Popper in the 30s compared this to was the the famous philosopher Sigmund Freud, who didn't have this this mechanism of falsification in his explanation of psychology. And I'm not so well versed in psychology, but from how I understood it, is that the behavior of a person and their psychology at the time is mostly explained through the experiences they made in the childhood. And so if you keep digging, you can always find things that explain current behavior, but there's no way of ever disproving that. So there's no inbuilt mechanism of saying, only if you had a certain experience in childhood can this explain this behavior today. But you pick a feature that you would say, because he was slapped in the face, he now goes around and slaps people in their faces. And you could cherry pick these facts. That's why Karl Popper called Sigmund Freud a pseudoscientist and called Albert Einstein a true scientist. That would be that model.
Well, I think that's a really fantastic point. I mean, if you find that you can do any experiment and still be right, then there's probably something wrong with the framework that you're using. And I think this comes back to a point that I wanted to make earlier about the pernicious lie that I think at least in Australia, and I think with my conversations with Chris, is also done in England, the lie that is told by some high school science teachers every year that, like, oh, you remember what we taught you last year? That was all a lie. None of that's true. We're going to teach you the real theory this year. And they do that year on year. And I think that's a really dangerous lie. So two really good examples, I think, to explain this are, so Hannes, you brought up the idea of Einstein's like descriptions of the theory of relativity. And I think going backwards a little further, it's the comparison between Newtonian physics and Einsteinian physics. Another one, a great one, is, you know, the sort of various versions of the model of the atom. But I'll go back to Newton just for a second. So the idea that, like, we learn Newtonian physics at high school, typically. You throw a ball, it's going to follow certain motions, force equals mass times acceleration, you know, inertia, these kind of ideas. For hundreds of years, those models, those very simple mathematical equations, competently describe pretty much everything. I mean, you can predict the motions. We sent rockets to the moon using just that mathematics. But when you deal with things that are going very, very fast, or over very long timescales, suddenly Newton's predictions don't work. And that's when Einstein comes in, right? So that was a high level of theory, you know, that arose from making observations that no longer fit the models that we were using to describe them. We got different answers. And so once we were confident that the experiments weren't flawed and that they were giving consistent results, because that's the first thing you do. If the experiment gives you a weird result, you try and check whether the experiment is trustworthy. If it is trustworthy, that's when you revise the theory. So the question then comes, like, and I think this is one of the important things that Hannes raised before as well, to appreciate how simpler models have value. I could use Einsteinian mechanics to describe me throwing a ball to Chris across a field. It'd take me about 6 hours to do the maths, right, if I was on the back of an envelope. It'd be very complicated, and it would give me a very accurate answer, probably to 60 or 70 decimal places. But it's not going to make a difference as to where Chris stands, like if I wanted to predict this, because I could just use Newtonian mechanics, and it'd give me a worse answer, a verifiably incorrect answer, an incomplete answer, but one that's more or less good enough for the purpose that we're looking at. And I think that's a really important thing that probably should be approached at high school. And I still hear this happening when I sort of survey my students. Like, did your high school teacher tell you what you learned last year was a lie? And year on year on year, even up to 2020 now, it's still happening. And the issue is then, as Hannes, you raised before, you reject the theory and you think, no, that's stupid, it's dumb, how silly were we to think that, as opposed to realizing this is an iterative process. And I think something that I liked what Chris said before was that the idea of scientific research and inquiry is this cyclical process of raising and answering questions.
Yeah, the time advances quickly. Should we try to actually find an answer again to Chris's question, because we went in very interesting directions. I think it was all very good, but we didn't answer the question.
What was the question again?
Is science to education fit for purpose? I'd say that really the damaging part where it's not fit for purpose is at high school. Because we're all products of a university education system, and I agree with Chris very much that, like, the key value, I think coming over and over again, the key value where science students really think like scientists or start to think like scientists is by doing research. That needs to be brought into undergraduate teaching more and more. My philosophy, or something I'm going to try sort of being given increasingly sort of like, you know, larger remit to try this, is to lead with a lab program and then have the lectures build off the lab program rather than the other way around, or, God forbid, have them completely disconnected like they have been at most places I've worked. That, I think, is a key feature of how we can improve university. But university more or less works. We're all products of it. You know, it's you find a way through to research if you're going to do it at some point. And if you don't develop an understanding of how research works, you generally aren't allowed to continue. You know, you'll tend to drop out, and then the system, and then the problem doesn't really propagate too much. But it's
gonna ignore the component of survivor bias here, but keep going.
Sure. Yeah. Well, then yeah. I'm now I'm not using a very scientific argument. I'm going to be right no matter what. Where I personally feel most uneasy is how science is taught at high school and what the implications that has for how the general public deals with information and how they deal with, like, you know, scientific ideas as to whether or not, like, you know, whether or not, like, you know, in this current climate, coronavirus is real. That's even a question. It's really scary. Whether or not in Australia the bushfires are a result of any links to climate change. That's really scary. So many people can just look at scientific ideas, be told something, and go, oh, okay, a smart person told me, so I believe it. And if that smart person is a sophist, a politician, someone with someone in a lobby group, well, then if you're not able to understand, and a scientist then says, oh, well, you know, I can't tell you a yes or no answer. These are the uncertainty levels that are sort of like, you know, built into our model. And so, like, I can say with this level of confidence, etc. And you have someone else who doesn't know what they're talking about, just go, no, it's definitely not climate change. It's definitely not a real virus. Well, if people don't understand that's how science works, and that we deal with uncertainty, and that we have to keep on shifting the goalposts based on the data we get, if people see that as inconsistent rather than very, very good and very sensible, then that's extremely dangerous for society. I see this eventually leading to the collapse of society, but I'm a catastrophist.
So on that bombshell, I think it's a good place to end the episode. I just have one final question. So it seems that we've focused on high school education as being one major area of improvement. So if you can have one wish or magic wand to do one thing, what would you change in high school education right now to affect change in society?
Wow, that's a tough one. I'd say, for me personally, the most important thing would be to lead with experiment and have students understand where the theories, the ideas and models that we have now, our current understanding of the world, how they arose from observations. And I think built into that comes the ideas of teaching the scientific method, teaching about how to construct a falsifiable hypothesis, and developing the vocabulary as a consequence of learning about the process rather than leading with the facts and then learning about the sort of like how they came about afterwards.
I would like an extra subject, which I guess we can just call philosophy, which includes science philosophy, because I want to overcome this dichotomy of having science and philosophy, and a science being separate from specific ways of thinking, of science being facts instead of a way to approach a problem. In this respect, it's just philosophy for me, and I want these to be taught together and the scientific thinking together with other ways of thinking.
So if I had the magic wand, I would go big and I would say I want to change how we do exams and how the knowledge we try to teach is actually kind of assessed. Because I feel like what I was talking about before, like this, that failure is sort of like either you're right or you're wrong, is a function of having those kinds of exams that you're either you have the facts or you don't. Either you get to the answer that your teacher wants you to get to or you don't. And I think changing what we ask from students and the kind of where, like, even not even like the, let's say, the final exam of a semester, but also throughout their like normal week, the kind of exercises that they're supposed to do need to change, I think. And I feel like when I was in school, I think there was sort of like a balance between questions that were just concerning facts that you had to reproduce, and then there was usually like a last question where you had to like kind of connect the concepts and kind of do your own work during the exam. But from what I'm hearing is that that proportion is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. You have like PISA in Europe trying to like forcing all the high schools into this very standardized system, and there's not a lot of room anymore for this kind of creative work. And I think, yeah, that really is a disadvantage if you want to go into science, because that connecting the dots, this like not having the correct answers, and there might not be a correct answer yet, is really, really important in science in general, but also for everything else.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I would change that for sure.
That's brilliant. I couldn't agree more with that. That's fantastic.
How about you, Chris? What would you change?
Mine's slightly meta. I think all three of you have some great ideas. I would like to see more pedagogical, I can't even say it, research, where we would say take cohorts and test out whether you're right, whether changing the syllabus and changing the way we assess people would actually change the outcomes or not, or if it's possible or not, because none of us are actual high school teachers. We don't really know how the students would engage with these new concepts. I think it would be fascinating to find out.
Run the experiment. Very good.
Run the experiment. Further research is needed.
This is maybe a very sciencey data answer. Yeah, give me more data, then we can talk about the change. I like that.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed our delve into science education. Huge thanks to Derek Roberts for joining us today. If you want to send comments, questions, or feedback, you can get in touch on Twitter @FRN-podcast, @FRNpodcast, or email under contact@FRN-podcast.com. Next episode, we take a look at the Nobel Prize and ask the question, does it cause scientists to lose it? If you want to support the show, consider becoming a Patreon. We have exciting rewards waiting for you. Music credits go to Jay Patterson. Thank you for listening, and please consider subscribing. See you in 2 weeks.
What I didn't mention is my anecdote why I respect Derek as a teacher so much. I don't even know if I told you that.
I've not heard this before.
We met in the organic chemistry class, which was my very first undergrad teaching experience. I was just a first year PhD student, had to teach organic chemistry lab, which I failed as an undergrad yet. So I was not
even in Germany.
Job,
so Germany is way harder.
Yeah, sure. It's true. It was a more difficult lab than what I was teaching, because this was biomedicine. I was studying chemistry for chemists, but still. And Derek kind of noticed, and I asked him a lot of questions, and he gave me the answer and he taught me how to teach without the students noticing, because they were listening to our conversation. They were there. So he told me things in a way that he knew I was getting what he meant, but they didn't. So taught me it was sometimes some details about the reactions we ran or something like that. Taught it to me in a way that it seemed self-evident, that he was sure I was knowing what I was, what he was speaking of, which I didn't know. But the students thought I would. So that was excellent.
I don't quite remember that, but I appreciate that. Well, thank you.